is the Freedom Fiends Weekend Edition, Hour 1, broadcasting from the Wormabago Mobile Command Module in the depths of Freedom Bayou, where the swamp meets the sea. And Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license that allows reuse by anyone except governments. And you can learn more about that at BIPCOT.org. That's BIPCOT.org. And my name is Ben Stone. Joining me by way of Fiend Phone is James Babb. James, you're way off into the middle of the woods somewhere in an undisclosed location, high atop a mountain right next to the ocean, down underneath the sea, talking through a tin can bouncing off a satellite through somebody's stolen Wi-Fi, and I'm doing almost the same down in the southern bayous of the deep south. So folks listening, if there's any cutouts or whatever, it's because we're bouncing this back and forth around the world just to get the message to you, and then off to our studios in GCN, where they're where Fiend Phone is putting all this message together and sending it out to you, the listener, folks. So James, how you doing, dude? It's been a little while since we talked.
Oh, I'm doing so good, Ben, and it's great to be with you. I am, my undisclosed location, I will give it away. I am in on the coast of Maine, right now in a town called Southwest Harbor, which is a really quaint little village on Mount Desert Island. And this is one of my favorite places in the whole world. So I'm just totally pumped up. I get to do hiking all the time here, and maybe some beer drinking and some eating. It's pretty much an idyllic lifestyle for me. So whoever I'm stealing this Wi-Fi from, thank you for supporting the Global Fiend Network and making it possible for me to talk to you, Ben.
As Bill Buprat says, we're terraforming the planet. Before we really get into the show today, I wanted to recap something that I talked about with MK and Chandler last week, and that was that how people are problem solvers. It's our nature. And really, government is just a problem. It's a problem that, you know, that we've encountered at this point in human history, and we've faced way bigger problems at times. You know, humans lived through the Ice Age. Humans lived at a time when the only tools that we had were what we could make out of rocks and and sticks and just animal skins and bones and things like this. And we not only survived those times, but we thrived. And we thrived without a central government. We thrived without a gang of thugs giving us laws and threatening us if we didn't obey. Humans have survived amazing things. Ice ages, you know, the last ice age, human population, scientists tell us through absolute archaeological evidence that is really hard to dispute, that humans actually thrived during the last ice age. And humans are, I don't want to get into a whole thing on this, but humans are a part of a group. The word jumps away from me at the moment. Let me pull up my old notes. I'm running off my memory at this point. But humans are a part of a group of animals that are kind of considered, the word escapes me at the moment, but there's a group of animals that are oversized among other animals that are like them. So, for instance, you know, the woolly mammoth was considerably larger than a regular elephant. There's several large, oversized species of birds, ostrich and several others that are kind of oddballs in their species. And humans are like that. We're like oversized versions of the group that we're a part of. And most of those oversized animals, the giant crocodiles, the giant sharks, all these big oversized animals, most of them went extinct, if not before the last ice age, during the last ice age. And yet, humans prospered during such hard times that, you know, other species were going extinct. Humans prospered. And we did that without a central government. We did that without central planning. We did that without bosses, you know, threatening us and telling us what to do and everything. So I just wanted to bring that back up from last week's conversation. But there was something that Megan had said, something that MK said, that humans have empathy. And I really wanted to emphasize that, as that was, that's one of our greatest traits that allowed us to be able to, in addition to being problem solvers, which was my point, having empathy is one of the things that allows us to survive as a species when other circumstances would not allow us to survive. Having empathy for one another creates a situation where it almost guarantees that we will survive. So in other words, here's an example. Humans like to watch game shows in the modern world. And the reason I think that people like to watch game shows, now some game shows are entertaining for a variety of different reasons, but what we really want to see is we want to see somebody win. We want to see that, you know, that 85-year-old grandma, we want to see her spin that big wheel and win. We want to see, that construction worker, we want to see him win. And I think this is one of the main reasons why humans like to watch game shows. Sure, there's goofiness and there's costumes and there's weird things going on in game shows. And there's trivia questions and all that kind of stuff. And we like to compete and think that we're smart because we can answer the questions or whatever. But really deep down inside, we get a thrill when other people prosper. And that's a part of human nature that I think is critical to human survival. We can actually rejoice when other people win. That's quite a trait if you think about it. The other half of that is we get depressed when we see sad people. We feel sad when we see other sad people. And, you know, the more, at least for me, I can only speak for myself, but I think this is species-wide. The more you tend to be in a big, huge, crowded city where no one wants to look each other in the eye, you just want to walk down the street and get to your destination, and you can't really be friendly with people. You kind of have to like not focus your eyes on people. You have to look the other way or look at your feet or just look ahead and just let people walk by you and never make eye contact and never smile and never greet anyone. You know how cities are like that. That, I think, that creates depression in the human mind, because you feel, even though you're crowded among people, you're isolated and by yourself. Now, contrast that to what I experience in living in the RV life, where we travel and go from campground to campground, and everyone's constantly on vacation. And when you are in that mode, you go into these campgrounds, almost everybody is smiling. People wave, total strangers you'll never see again. They're happy. They wave at you. You wave back. Everybody's smiling. And it just creates a sort of euphoria in the campground. Everybody's in this together. Everybody's enjoying this experience. You know, everybody's carefree. And it's just a happy time for everybody. And that joy is contagious. And I really think that that's one of the things that, as anarchists, we don't emphasize enough, that if you remove government and you remove all those forced authorities and that monopoly of authority upon us and those top-down orders that are always enforced at the point of a bayonet or the point of a gun, if you take all that stuff away, we want to love each other. We want to be friendly with each other. We want to help each other. We want to see each other succeed. And I really think that more and more, as anarchists understand that and put an emphasis on that as a message, not as a religious message like MK was talking about last week, but as a matter of truth and as a matter of understanding the human psyche, I think we're well on our way to providing an angle that we can present to people that overcomes a lot of their objections to the idea of living without a government. Anyway, that was a lot longer of a ramble than I meant for it to be. Jim, I promise I'll give you a chance to speak today at some point in time.
No, I like what you said. I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, we are empathic creatures. And I think our brain, like when we see a person experience something, I think there's like our brain actually models that in our own mind, like some suffering or some joy. Like we're actually experiencing, you know, like our brain is trying to understand and is actually like simulating the same to a lesser degree, though, that our own brain. And, you know, I think maybe some people are more sensitive to that than others, but I think that's definitely a human trait that has allowed us basically to work as cooperative creatures. We're not just individuals, you know, in a on a plane somewhere. We are social creatures, and I think that's one of the key mechanisms that makes that possible.
You know, if that weren't true, you think about reading a book, a fiction book, you know, like a novel, or think about watching a movie or watching a television show that has drama where you attach yourself to, you know, the hero and the villain, and you set aside, there's a phrase for it that leaves my mind at the moment, but you set aside the real world that you live in and you kind of put yourself into that movie or into that book or whatever. And I think that's along the same lines. You know, you sort of, in your mind,
suspend disbelief.
Yeah, exactly. That was the phrase I was trying to remember. And I think that ability to do that is very much tied up in our ability to have empathy for somebody else, to be able to see somebody in a book or in a movie or whatever and relate to that character and want them to succeed or to win or to, you know, to save the day or whatever that it is that the story wants.
Sure. You know, and it's also something that can be used to manipulate other people. And I think those, you know, the sociopaths have sort of figured that out. I mean, why do you think like the U.S. government invested in Top Gun as a movie, you know, to build this connection between you and a military person, right? To connect you to what's going on there. So we feel this empathy for those soldiers, you know, across the world. Like, you know, that's, we want them to succeed because of this sort of, you know, they've sort of tapped into that channel in our brains where we can feel that empathy. But, you know, some of us are also looking at the other side, and, you know, those that are, you know, more aware are looking at the downside of what's happening. We feel empathy with the victims of the invasion.
Yeah. Folks, stick with us. We're going to break away for a moment with the market. We'll be right back.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Ben Stone with James Babb. So, James, we were talking before the break about empathy.
Right.
Did we finish that, or do we want to jump into the next topic? Or
well, I was kind of thinking some more about that, and the way sort of the opponents of freedom exploit this characteristic. You know, have you ever thought about why images of the victims of war are basically forbidden on CNN and Fox News, and they intentionally need to make sure that people don't feel empathy for the people that the government is harming, right? It's crucial to their propaganda. They're not going to count the victims. They're not going to let you see a photo of their bodies. You don't want to see their bombed out village, nothing. You know, this is just heroes doing heroes' work, just like the movies. And, you know, and because they know if we start seeing, wait a minute, that looked like a family, you know, that, remember the collateral murder video that was so famous Manning released? Why was that so devastating to their effort? Why were they so freaked out about that? Because it showed a minivan getting shot to hell by soldiers in a foreign land.
Yeah, okay? With children in the minivan.
And children and people joking about it.
Yeah.
Right? Horrific, right? That's why, and look how hard they freaked out about that particular security leak. You know, the security leaks happen all the time, but that was intolerable. That person had to be crushed. I think we need to remember as we're going forward, we need to, you know, help people tap into their empathy, you know, to feel both sides and to feel for all of humanity.
You know, I think if there was any one thing that really fired the government up to hate Manning and to really come down and really come out with the crazy sentence that they came out with and the horrible, brutal treatment that Manning had to put up with, I think it was that video because, you know, the other people exposed other things that were nowhere near, that the government didn't react anywhere near as badly over. But that video struck home to the point of where, you know, what you saw was, in case people are not aware of this thing, you saw a journalist being murdered. And then you saw some just regular people see this poor guy get killed, and a guy with his family who lives in that neighborhood is like, oh man, here's a person who needs help, I'll help them. And he ends up getting himself and his family killed over it, or probably killed over it. And like you said, the soldiers are joking about it. They're like, ha ha ha, what's what he gets for bringing his family to a war zone. No, dude, you brought the war zone to him. You're the one going into his neighborhood, killing him and his family. It's not the other way around. But you know, that thing was what it was that the government looked at and said, holy crap, we can't let this go out. But it's too late. It's like, you know, urine in the swimming pool. You can't take it out once it hits the internet. And that's Manning's great sin and why Manning is now, you know, being punished like that. I think right. Also, you know, I also wanted, a thing I was thinking about when you were talking about that was, let's consider, think in your mind of the very, I hate to use the word best, but the most accurate World War II movie that you can think of. And I can think of a couple. You know, there was the one with the Russian sniper and the German sniper. That was a very realistic movie. And there was one with Tom Hanks where he was saving Private Ryan. These were very realistic movies about World War II. But the one glaring thing that was left out of both of those movies was, as you look at the rubble that was created of towns and of cities, and you look at the devastation that the bombing and the fighting had done with burned out factories and blown up houses and everything, there's one really stark thing that was missing from every single movie about World War II, and that is the piles of civilian bodies from those bombings. People lived in those houses when they were bombed and when they were attacked. They had no idea the war was about to come upon them, and bam, the war was there. And when those soldiers were going through those buildings, they were literally having to move rotting corpses out of the way to hide in those little spots and shoot at each other. And that's never portrayed in the movies and never will be portrayed in the movies, probably.
Right, because if people saw that, what would happen to support for war?
Yeah.
Right? That product would not be so popular anymore.
Yeah. The glamour would fade away really quick. Well, folks, stick with us. We're going to step away from the market for a moment on the Freedom Fiends.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Freedom Fiends. So, James, we were talking about... Well, the last thing I was talking about before the break was how movies will never really show the horrors of war. You know, I think of pictures of the bombing of Dresden. Dresden being a German city that the Allies bombed, according to Winston Churchill. So, if you think I'm just making this up, or you think I'm some crazy leftist who's just anti-war, just because I hate America or whatever, all that nonsense goes right out the window when you realize that Winston Churchill said, words coming out of Winston Churchill's mouth, that the bombing of Dresden was strictly for terror purposes. It was to punish the German people and to scare them. It had nothing. It was not a military target in any way. There was no military targets there. It was a refugee city that had been spared from the bombings, and refugees went there expecting Dresden to be left alone because it was not a military city. It was not any kind of strategic target, and yet the Allies, including Americans, went there and just firebombed the city, used high explosives on the city, blasted the city horribly, killing more civilians in Dresden than were killed in Hiroshima or in Nagasaki. And
wow.
American pilots, American fighter pilots were, and this is according to Yeager, who was one of the, who was the guy who broke the speed of sound. According to Yeager, who was a fighter pilot at the time, he was instructed, and the other fighter pilots were instructed, to strafe the roads with the refugees leaving Dresden. So as the people, you know, with their families, maybe pulling a handcart or walking along with their families trying to get out of this burning city, as they were trying to flee the city, not military, not lines of military, not tanks, not military personnel, regular people, old people, people who weren't healthy enough or weren't in the right age group for the Germans to force them to go into the military. That's the people that were hiding in Dresden. And when the city was burning, they're trying to leave, and American pilots were ordered to fly down onto the roads and strafe them with automatic weapons and kill them. And that was an American order to American pilots, according to American hero, the pilot Yeager. So that is never going to be shown in American cinemas. That is never going to be on mainstream American movies. That type of stuff, that type of atrocities that Americans that they did. American soldiers, American pilots followed those orders.
Right, just following orders, right? Like if things had been differently, perhaps they would have been on trial in Nuremberg, you know, or some other city.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like this is obviously, you know, an example of winners writing the history. And, you know, of course, that was never included in my history class in government school. It was all like the heroic Allies defeated the evil Nazis and we all lived happily ever after in freedom. You know, like just a joke of history. You know, it was taught to me as a kid.
Yeah, it's really a shame that propaganda like this, and this is what brought us off onto this direction. Propaganda is used to manipulate the minds of people, and the way that propaganda works is by using those same strengths that humans have, like empathy. The propaganda specialists use those strengths to then do something horribly evil with that strength of ours turns into a weakness. It's a weird perversion of human tendencies.
It is, but you know, I guess that's so. Let's make that, you know, part of our job to, you know, to let people use their empathy for good, not let the enemies of freedom hijack that channel in our brain. Like it's up to us to make sure that people know the truth. Brake, you had an interesting analogy about us as truth seekers being like miners. Maybe you'd like to recap that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that was just a thought that came to me the other night. I was thinking, you know, actually, I think I might have been listening to some music, and I might have been listening to, because I was listening to a bunch of music that night, and I might have been listening to that song, Miner for a Heart of Gold, you know, that, can't remember the guy's name, but anyway, old guy from the 60s. Anyway, my thought was that anarchists in America, And to a certain extent everywhere else as well, but anarchists in America are miners for truth in a mountain of lies. We're like prospectors looking for truth in a mountain of lies. We just dig and dig, and we sample, and we go from place to place looking for truth. And we're digging and we're digging, trying to push aside all the lies. And when we find it, it's like a gem. It's like, oh, here's this precious little stone that exists in such a rarity that we have to dig this whole mountain to find it.
I think that's a great analogy. And, you know, every once in a while, you know, we lose a few miners, you know, trapped in a tunnel below in a tragic accident.
Yep. Yeah, there's...
You do get the gems.
Yeah.
You do get them. But, you know, we have some pretty good excavating tools now since they invented the internet. I must say, like, for those that want to seek the truth, maybe there's a lot more mountain to go through, but we've got some great tools now for sifting through the information. I mean, and I'm continuously amazed that, you know, that folks now have basically the sum of human knowledge available on their phone in their pocket, right? So our ability to access truth is unprecedented in the history of humanity, right? I mean, the mountain is bigger, but we've got some big tools to work it with. So, you know, I think there's some great possibility there.
You know, a couple of years back, this was around 2012, around the changeover from 2012 to 2013, I started poking around. I was doing some research on the CIA, and I started poking around on the CIA's website. And this is all open to the public. There's nothing, you know, that I was looking at that was hidden. I didn't hack into anything, or I didn't do anything illegal. It was all available. It's there's website's a little clumsy, and it took me a couple months of going there every day to really figure out how their system of how things are arranged there are. Then again, I'm kind of slow on that kind of thing, so somebody else would probably pick it up quicker. But after a few months of digging around almost daily on the CIA's website, I started coming up with papers that were written by CIA personnel to other CIA personnel that's open to the public. You can go there and look at it yourself. And exposing all kinds of things, justifying behavior, talking about letters that were sent to to different presidents, talking about meetings. And for example, one thing I found was when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, Jimmy Carter was president, and he came out with a news conference and immediately said, "We had no idea this was going to happen. We had no clue at all. This is completely a surprise to us." And right after that happened, the CIA kind of went a little bit nuts, and they started trying to, you know, justify how can the president say that he didn't know this was happening. We had conferences with him, and so the CIA actually documented internally their conferences that they had with Jimmy Carter to tell him that the Soviets were building up, to tell him that the Soviets were getting ready to invade Afghanistan. They told him troop size. They told him how many rows of tanks there were. They gave him all the information, and he knew good and well that the Soviets were about to invade Afghanistan. Then when they invaded, he stood up there and lied to the American people and said, "We had no idea this was about to happen." So as I'm digging through all this stuff on the CIA's website, it dawned on me that the vast amount of information that is available that in the heart, it convicts those people in government of all kinds of things that they're guilty of. And they don't even
Times over.
Oh, yeah. And they don't even make that much of an effort to hide it. And all that wealth of information is there. All you have to do is look. Go ahead, Jim.
Couldn't we ask for them to spend a little bit more effort to cover up their evil deeds?
You would think.
They're so lazy. They're so sloppy. Like, come on. Don't we deserve to at least have a little bit of effort to conceal this when you're trying to lie to us? Like, they don't even care. They're like, you know what? So what if people know what we did? They'll probably give us a parade for it later. I mean,
did you ever see the movie Dog Day Afternoon?
I don't think so.
There's the quick premise of the movie. There's a guy and his partner that rob a bank, and the bank robbery goes wrong, and they end up being barricaded in there. And this is in New York City. And it's a really good movie, Dog Day Afternoon. If anybody who wants to watch it, it's really good. Al Pacino. Al Pacino comes out of the bank. His partner's holding the hostages inside. He comes out of the bank to talk to the police negotiator that's going to try to figure out what they can do to get them out of the bank. And the police negotiator's lying to him and telling him, "Oh, yeah, we're going to do all this stuff." And Al Pacino looks at him and he taps his own mouth and he says, "Kiss me." And he says, "What?" The cop says, "What?" And Al Pacino says, kiss me right here, kiss me. And he says, "What are you talking about?" And Al Pacino says, and I can't use the word on the radio, but he says, "I like to be kissed when I'm being beep." And the cop just looks at him and he says, "Yeah, you know," and it's kind of like that with the government. If you're going to do all that, just at least give us a kiss, you know? But that's totally not radio friendly, right? But I mean, it's the truth. You feel that way sometimes. Like, hey, come on. You're going to lie to us like this? Hey, at least give me a kiss, right?
Put a little effort into it, for gosh sakes, you know? I mean, don't we deserve that? Like, don't we deserve a well-crafted lie, at least, you know?
It's insulting.
But, we're talking about that collateral murder video where the rescue team was attacked.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I thought, wow, how horrible is that? But it made me think of something about these drone strikes that the U.S. government does in places like Pakistan. And do you remember a couple years ago, Glenn Greenwald revealed, like he had at least reported on the fact that it's a common procedure that they do a drone strike. And then when the rescue people arrive to try to remove the bodies and assist the wounded, they attack again immediately.
Yeah, it's called
a
double tap.
To kill those people.
Yeah, double tap.
How sick is that? I mean, and then, you know, and as a contrast, we have this, you know, and I don't know a whole lot about it, but this, they're calling it a terrorist shooting in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where somebody evidently shot up a military recruitment station. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, that was a week ago or something like that. But yeah, and it was all military targets.
That was called a terrorist attack. You know, attacking a military target.
You're listening Stick with us, folks. To the we'll Freedom be right back. Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Freedom Fiends, wrapping up the first hour. James, as we went into the break, you had mentioned that horrible shooting in Tennessee. And I want to be clear, we're not trying to defend some crazy person that murders people. That's not the point here at all. But what we want to point out is, well, first off, like you said, right as we went into the break, it was kind of a military target. If you believe that it's okay to go into for the U.S. military to go into the Middle East, into foreign countries and kill military targets there, how can you be shocked when somebody, and I don't even know the guy's motivations, it could all be a false flag thrown up, it could be anything, I don't know, but how can you be so upset when a military target is targeted in the U.S., when the U.S. is targeting military targets and non-military targets on a daily basis? But then, Jim, you also brought, during the break, you brought up another thought on the quantity of soldiers that are dying. What was that about?
Well, I was just looking at this news report about Chattanooga because I try not to even follow these things until I give it like a couple weeks for the official people to get their story straight and get the set of lies, you know, cemented so we can even comment on it.
Right.
But, they're using words like horrific shooting and it was a rampage and, you know, it's like, oh, this is horrible, horrible. And no doubt it was a horrible event for those involved. But they were attacking a military target. And as you said, if you believe in, you know, it's okay for a military to attack a military, well, okay, that's what you're supporting. But, I mean, look at what the U.S. government is doing in these other countries when they're blowing up minivans full of rescuers and doing the double-tap drone strikes, targeting wedding parties, okay? Like, who's the real terrorist here, right? Like, if it's really hard to be consistent if you want to be against terror and somehow support those troops.
Right.
And, you know, people are outraged that, yeah, I think, I think there's like, I don't know, four or five people were killed in this shooting. These are Marines were killed in this shooting in Chattanooga. But then I, you know, we were talking about this other headline from a few days ago, where the headline is 238,000 U.S. veterans died waiting for health care due to a leaked document. And this was reported on RT. That's horrific.
Yeah.
That's too high. I mean, you want to support the troops? Well, what is wrong with the VA system? I mean, that they would just discard their used soldiers in that manner.
Yeah.
As garbage, it seems like. There's just nothing but just, it's like a spent ammo shell.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we used you, on to the next weapon to be spent. Just horrible. Just I can't, it's just hard to even fathom that level of disregard for human beings. Horrible.
You know, I really think we can't emphasize that enough, that if a person considers himself patriotic, or they think, you know, that the American troops are protecting them, or however they justify the belief system that they have to think that the United States needs this massive army and presence all around the world and having bases in all these different countries, however you justify and all of that behavior, then to sit back and watch the American government, the United States, the Washington, D.C. government, fail to support, you know, the wounded veterans that come back, that their lives are destroyed, they've got limbs lost, they're struggling to just make it from a day-to-day basis, and the government pretty much just says, too bad about you losing your legs, here's a medal, I'll pin that on your chest, and we'll have a politician have a photo op taking a picture with you, but after that, you're pretty much on your own. Go out and figure out how to rehabilitate yourself, or stand in line endlessly at the VA hospital and hope you don't catch something in the process, or hope we don't accidentally give you the wrong medication or accidentally inject you with hepatitis or something else that the VA is known to have done. You know, it's just,
wow.
Where's the outrage?
Right.
Why is Washington, D.C. existing? Sorry, I was walking all over you there, James.
No, that's exactly the right point to take away from this. And, I mean, what it really comes down to is, like, look, if you want to support the troops, you need to basically reject the U.S. federal government. You need to say, you know, enough of this. We will no longer obey. We will no longer cooperate. This has got to stop immediately.
When we get back from this break, we'll be back with the second hour of the Freedom Fiends. The news is coming up. Don't let it drag you down. Stick with us.
Trigger warning. This is the Freedom Fiends, Hour 2. Broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's Low Orbit Ion Cannon, high atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite, LibPair 2017, in the Alpha Centauri region. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So sorry, Nancy Pelosi. Sorry, Obama. You cannot use the Freedom Fiends. But everyone else, you can. So we are here. I'm James Babb. I'm with Ben Stone. Again, it's great to be with you, Ben.
Yeah, good to be with you, James. We should also mention in this hour, because a lot of the radio stations only carry the second hour, some only carry the first hour, that we are bouncing off satellites and tin cans and over unauthorized Wi-Fis of different places. And so if you hear cutouts or drops or if there's delays, we are using FiendPhone, which is much better than any other process that we've found out there. But there are limitations as to what we can do, considering that both James and myself are in quite remote locations. I'm literally sitting a few dozen yards from a swamp in southern Alabama, just about a mile away from the Gulf of Mexico. And James is way up there in Maine, off in the beautiful coastline of Maine, and we're bouncing this through the GCN studios in the Midwest. So if you do hear a delay, or if there's an awkward pause or some kind of a jumble of the sound, it is because we are shooting this through so many different avenues and electronic bumps and to try to get it back and forth to GCN headquarters.
But thank goodness we have Fiend Phone. This is an amazing tool that has enabled the global fiend empire. we have fiends in multiple continents. All, you know, this is in fact, Derek Slopey, who is the programmer who has worked with Michael W. Dean to develop Fiend Phone, is a Mainer, and I have had the pleasure of hanging out with Derek this weekend and his lovely family. And I just learned something about Derek that I thought was really impressive. For those that were at Porkfest recently, you may have seen a vending machine, okay? And it looked like just about any other vending machine you may see, except it was filled with interesting items like bullets or a home marijuana test kit, various other useful items. He gutted this machine and reprogrammed it to accept Bitcoin, okay? And one of the things that you could buy with Bitcoin out of the vending machine were dollars that were in the machine. So you could buy dollars with Bitcoin. You could buy Bitcoin with dollars. You could buy ammo. You could buy all of these wonderful things. It had some candy bars, some, you know, it's like... Derek spent months on this, completely gutting it and reprogramming it and redesigning it, and added this enormous amount of functionality to it. And even at the time I was admiring this machine, I didn't realize the scope of that project and how impressive that was. So cheers to Derek Slopey, the programmer of Fiend Phone and with so many talents. So it's great to have you on the team, Derek.
Derek really is amazing, and he's just a joy to be around. He's so much fun because you can just see the gears working in his mind constantly. You can just like see it behind his eyes. There's this massive computer that's just grinding out information constantly. It's really neat to be around him.
Yeah, we need more guys like that on our team, definitely.
And we do have, you know, these are unsung heroes. We have a lot of these guys. There's some obvious ones like Cody Wilson, and you see people like, some of the hackers that have become famous in the last few years, some under very sad circumstances that they've faced their demise because of their hacking abilities. But there's so many unsung heroes that are out there that are doing this kind of stuff to spread freedom and to spread the message of liberty, that I really can't express enough how much I appreciate that background work that they're
right
doing.
Right on. I agree completely. And right, they are unsung heroes, and they're not out there getting their faces on things. They're not jumping to the front of somebody else's parade. They're not in the middle of some Facebook drama. They're just quietly being brilliant and producing.
Yeah. You know, not long ago, I kind of made a little fuss about this a week or two ago on Twitter, that there was a company that was going to come out at DEF CON, and they had these little machines that you could take and set up at different locations, and they could pick up Wi-Fi from, like, I can't remember now, it was like a mile away, and then send the message of the Wi-Fi like another mile, so that you could pretty much in a big city, you could utilize Wi-Fi anonymously. If you wanted to, let's say you were a person like Snowden and you had a lot of information that you needed to get to some reporter somewhere, you could use a box like this and get that information to somebody safely and anonymously. Keeping in mind that, if Snowden were trying to do what he did today, he wouldn't be able to, because the avenues that Snowden used to get that information to Greenwald have been closed. Those ports have been closed by the government, and you can't use the tools that Snowden used to anonymously and safely get information to a reporter to get that stuff out. So this box was going to be built. And it was being built. There were prototypes of it, and they were in the process of manufacturing them and getting ready to send them out. And they were going to do a pitch for it at DEF CON. And then all of a sudden, the company has to come out with vague statements and saying, we can't tell you why, but we had to destroy all of our stock of these, and they're no longer for sale. You can't buy them. Don't order them. Don't try to send us money. We're no longer manufacturing them, and we can't tell you why. And that's all we can tell you, and sorry, wish we had more to tell you. And you know what happened.
We're not saying we were contacted by the government, but...
Right, exactly.
But...
And you see their Twitter feed on this, and other people made the accusation, look, the NSA has done this. They've put letters. There's a phrase for it. A national security letter is what you get when they send you a letter, or they hand it to you in person that says, you know, we're going to do this and you're not going to say anything. If you say anything other than this allowed, you know, we'll allow you to say this phrase and that's all you're allowed to say. And if you say anything more than that, you're a terrorist and we'll throw you in prison. That's basically what the national security letters say. And so other people on the Twitter feed of this company, and I don't even want to mention them because I don't want to give them any worse attention than they've already got, but other people on the feed were saying, it looks like this is what's happened, and all they could do is hit the like and repost that same post. They couldn't actually comment on it, but they're reposting it saying, like, kind of a code way of saying, yeah, that's what happened, you know? And who knows how many things like this the government has shut down. We know email companies that were doing encrypted email and private email and anonymous email. The government has gone after them. Different governments, not only the U.S. government, the Irish government and the U.K. government and other governments of the world have gone after these people because they're terrified of the idea that there are people doing stuff that the government can't control. And it terrifies. It terrifies thugs.
Right. Do you remember LavaBit?
Yeah, exactly.
LavaBit. Yeah. He shut down his entire company rather than have to and give a back door to some thugs.
Yeah.
he said, I'm not gonna play that. If that's the cost of doing business, I'm out of business.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sad that he had a great business that was destroyed by that, but what an upstanding man.
Yeah.
Like I'm glad that he put his principles. Do you think AT&T is gonna put those principles out there? No,
not a chance.
Think Verizon's going to care? You know, like they probably don't even need to get a threat. They just probably need to get a, hey, it's Billy over here. Yeah, I need some more of that data you got. Oh, help yourself.
Well, and that's the same thing with even non-tech companies like Walmart or Sears or whoever, you know, Ford. It doesn't matter who the company is. The government comes to them and says, hey, go ahead and just install this in all your new cars you're producing. And they just nod their head because they know their monopoly in the market depends upon their relationship with the government. So, you know, they come to some giant retailer and they say, hey, just by chance, you wouldn't want to give us all your security tapes for the last 6 months. Yeah, here they are. You know, no warrant, no explanation, no news release. Just, yeah, there it is. There you go.
What are we going to do about it?
Do you use
an encrypted phone? Do you use something like Redfone or Signal or communications?
I have an encrypted phone that is the as best as I can tell, and it's been supplied to me by a wonderful hacker that is not charging me to use it, not charging me to have it, and he has supplied that for me, and I can speak with people upon that network in a military encrypted version. It's really handy. And there, you know, it's not 100% secure. Nothing is 100% secure. So, for instance, if they're sitting, you know, 200 yards away with a van and a high-powered microphone, it doesn't matter if you're talking on an encrypted phone. They can hear you anyway. Or if they have...
Of course.
You know, if they've downloaded something into your laptop computer so that they can turn on your microphone and listen through it, it doesn't matter. They're going to hear it one way or the other. And just to throw out, you know, it's not a matter of paranoia. There's in the Snowden releases that have come through Glenn Greenwald, it actually shows that, yes, they actually do have software that they have sent out in bulk to infect computers so that they can take over your laptop, turn on your mic at any time they want, record whatever that your laptop mic will say, and the same thing with your video camera that's built into your laptop, which I'm looking right into the camera right now as I'm saying this. That's all been, you know, exposed out there as being 10 years ago when we'd say, or even 5 years ago, people would say we were crazy foil hatters for saying that the government.
Oh, yeah,
could
you're
do
just
that.
A conspiracy nut.
Yeah,
you're a nut.
But
that,
now.
Like, they would never do that.
Yeah, exactly. Why would they? But now it comes out. Yeah, yeah, they do. Yeah, there it is. Oh, but they wouldn't keep that information, right?
Didn't he wiretap somebody?
Oh, we're having so much fun. Time to break for the market to do its business and pay for us to be here. Stick with us, folks. We'll be right back.
Worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Freedom Fiends. I'm Ben Stone. With me is James Babb. James, I wanted to, you and I were talking about, before we started the show today, about this article. It was featured over at, notbeinggoverned.com, the art of not being governed, which the actual website is, notbeinggoverned.com. And the name of the article is "The Fundamental Flaw in Non-Anarchistic Libertarian Thought." It also appeared at the author's website, and it's been bouncing around for a couple weeks now. It's a really good article. I'll try to get a link in today's show notes for it. If you're listening on the radio, you can get over to about an hour after the show airs. You can get over to freedomfiends.com, freedomfiends.com, and hit the show notes there, and there'll be a link to this article in the show notes. So the quote that that you had sent to me when we first started talking about what we were going to talk about today, I'll read that quote from this article. It says, "America's constitutionally limited representative republic failed for precisely the same reason that other political systems such as socialism and communism always fail. They neglect to account for human nature, which dictates that individuals will typically act in their own best interests, including individuals which comprise the institution of government." Now, this goes to, this is really a restatement of what Mises spent his life saying. Human beings tend to do that which they feel is their best option for themselves. It's not that we're monsters because we're selfish. It's not that we're bad or evil because we think of ourselves. All animals kind of have a tendency to think about what's best for themselves, and humans are like that. And humans have a tendency to make the decisions that they feel are going to be best for themselves. Now, sometimes we make decisions that, you know, that are purely, well, this will help society, or this will help my family, or this will help this poor guy, you know, who's down on his luck or whatever. We make those decisions on a regular basis. We're kind-hearted and we do these things. But the overall tendency of humans is to make decisions based on what we feel is best for ourselves. And so if you echo, and what this article is referencing, just in this one little phrase that I just read, what the article is talking about is that if you realize that no matter what the politician says to you, no matter what the bureaucrat, no matter what that bureaucrat's job might happen to be, and no matter who you're talking about and what level of government, from the very top to the very bottom, the human tendency is to do what's best for that person, not what's best for you or the public or anything else. And when you realize that, when it comes to a politician, you might think, oh, this one politician, he's a great guy. But when you realize that given the opportunity of power, he's going to use that power for himself. And then the article fleshes that out. We'll talk about it a little bit more in the longer segment that we have coming up. But is that kind of what was striking you in that article, James?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I should note that the author is Rand Eastwood, and his blog is randeastwood.com. So people can grab that article, and looks like a bunch of other stuff there. I just think it really nails it. I mean, because we have a lot of libertarian friends that were like, oh, if we could just, you know, if we could just get a handle on government again, if we could just mold it into what we want it to be, we could get the right guys in there, we could get back to the Constitution. I hear this stuff all the time. And it's flawed thinking. It's not going to get us to where we need to be, which would be total freedom without this monopoly of force pointing guns at us all the time. There's just no way to make that work. So I think that is one of the damning facts that reveals that the futility of statism. But we can get into the others as we come back in the next segment, because this is a very deep topic.
You know, and it's often, I think, one of the problems that people who want a small government are often referred to as minarchists. So whether we're talking about a constitutionalist or whether we're talking about an actual minarchist who wants a minimal government, or, you know, a constitutionalist is a person who believes that government will obey a piece of paper and somehow that will keep them in control. But whatever your beliefs in that system are, essentially, it's the same idea that people will go against their nature and think about the good of all rather than the obviousness of thinking for themselves. And that's really, that's the flaw of socialism, really.
Yeah.
So,
surprise, it doesn't work.
When we get back from this break, we're going to get into this a little bit more. But in the meantime, here comes the market at us.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Freedom Fiends. I'm Ben Stone with James Babb, and the article that we're talking about, it can be found, first off, in the show notes at freedomfiends.com. I almost said badquaker.com. My old habits are hard to break. But we'll have the article link to it in the show notes today. It appears at the website, The Art of Not Being Governed, and also at the author's website, which was, is it randeastwood.com?
Rand Eastwood.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's several other articles there, too. Have you poked around on that website?
I just started. I'm like, wow, how come I'm not reading this every day? It's like, it looks like he's really got some great stuff there.
Yeah, he's done some good work. So the article that we're talking about is titled The Fundamental Flaw in Non-Anarchistic Libertarian Thought. And the image that he has, at least the one on theartofnotbeinggoverned.com, is a really good image. I've seen it several times. It's a large group of people waving banners and flags, and they've got ropes attached to the statue of the great leader, and they're yanking him down. They're pulling down the great leader. Yeah, we're getting rid of tyranny. And it's kind of one of those Stalin-looking or Lenin-looking statues. And the people are yanking it down, or maybe Saddam Hussein. They're yanking that statue down, defeat the tyrant. And as they're doing so, this is on a giant wheel mechanism that just pulls another statue out of the ground and props the next one up. And the idea is that's what revolution does. When you have a revolution and you're just fed up, you're sick of this tyrant, you're sick of this government that lords over us and tells us how to live every aspect of our life and beats us down if we object to it, and you're tired of that and you just wave your banners, let your beards grow, whip those ropes out, start pulling down the great leader, and what happens is the next great leader just pulls right up into his place, and out goes the old boss, in comes the new boss, same as it was before, and you know, all the beards have grown longer overnight, and we won't be fooled again, and yet we are, over and over and over and over.
Does it have to be that way, Ben?
No. If we keep doing the same thing, we'll keep getting the same results. Yeah. If you keep voting to get the great man in, you're going to keep getting another great man, and he's going to be just like the last one. If you keep having a revolution and, you know, a warring factors, and you rip the society apart, and then you bring in the next great leader, you're going to have the same thing as you had before. So the answer is not in doing the same thing that you've been doing right along, putting all your faith in yet another, great politician that now this guy is going to do it for real. This time for sure. That's the flaw in the thinking.
Yeah. Let me read another a short line from this article that I think really sort of nails that. This fact necessitates the trial of something new, something better, a more effective, nonviolent means of creating free, peaceful, and prosperous societies, and casting of the idea of government, even a constitutionally limited government, onto the scrap heap of history. Yeah, we tried that in every way we could think of. It doesn't work, right? People need to understand that. It's time to just discard this old idea. It's like chattel slavery, right? We look back now and be like, oh, how primitive and barbaric.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, those olden days were terrible. Look what they did to people, right? I am confident that future generations will look back at us toiling under the state and what the politicians are doing to people with the prisons and the wars, and say, like, how was that allowed to happen? Well, those people were very primitive back then. They hadn't figured it out. One of the other points that he brings up in this article, and it's something that I mention from time to time when I'm trying to make a case for anarchism, is the number of people that have been murdered by their own government in the past century.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's hard to even believe this is true, but I've seen, anywhere from 200 to maybe 500 million, you know, I would say 200 million is a very conservative estimate.
Yeah.
Of the number of people that have been murdered, not in a war, okay, not getting bombed by the other side, but getting killed by their own government as it passed sent or... I don't even know if that would count, like, people that starve to death when the central planners, like, get it wrong and there's not enough food. I mean, it's just unbelievable the pile of bodies that statism has left in its wake, and that, you know, I can't believe people are still defending this system. It's really hard to understand.
It really is amazing. And one of the excuses, you know, you hear this from historians all the time when referencing slavery. They talk about slavery and they say, well, you know, things were different back then. It was a different morality and people had a different understanding of what rights were like and people had a different understanding of racism. But that's an absolute lie. If you go back and actually read what people like Lysander Spooner and others had to say, there were huge amounts of the public in America at the time in the early 1800s and even in the early 1700s and even in the 1600s that said slavery is immoral, it is wrong, you cannot do it. And then there were apologists like Thomas Jefferson, for example, who said, yeah, I agree, slavery is horrible, it's wrong, we should not do that. And while he's saying those words, he owns literally hundreds of slaves. But his excuse was, well, but there's no safe process for dismantling this system that we have. So since we can't dismantle this system, we have to keep working with it and trying to adjust it on the edges. And Jefferson actually made the argument that you can't just release all your slaves because those poor people, those poor simpletons, they haven't been taught how to take care of themselves. They're not mature enough. They haven't had the responsibility of taking care of themselves. So as much
as we... sound familiar at all?
It's exactly like the argument for statism. So as much as we know that slavery is bad, and this was literally Jefferson's argument, as much as we know slavery is bad, and as much as we want to take the system down and replace it with freedom, we just can't do it all at once. We have to use the processes of government, and we have to do it slowly, and we have to figure these processes out slowly, because these people just...
Baby steps.
Yeah.
Baby steps.
Yeah, we just can't trust them to be free on their own. And this is the exact argument that statists make today. Oh, if the government wasn't here, bands of marauders would just go through the streets and doing this and that. Well, what do you call those police that are doing that now? You know, how many?
But, you know, I think it's even less than that. I think it's not even bands of marauders people are afraid of. They're like, but I don't know how I'm going to drive on a free road. Like, or I don't know who's going to empty the trash at a national park. They're willing to put up with hundreds of millions of bodies to make sure that there's a park ranger. Like, it's that, like, trivial, I think. Like, people are just so, I don't know why they cling to this. But getting back to this article, as another subject that I'm, you know, constantly trying to deal with, it's saying, like, look, we're not the ones that need to explain how things are going to work.
Right.
Without this coercive system in place. We're not the ones that need to explain it, okay? We need to turn the tables and say, look, you've got a system. It just killed a couple hundred million, okay? It stinks. Results are awful. How are you going to make it work?
Yeah.
Okay? You explain to me how we're going to have roads without killing hundreds of millions of more people in the next century. I'm waiting for your answer, okay? Because it's not up to us to explain. We're not the central planners that have all these ideas for how people should live their lives. Let these people tell us how it's going to work this time.
I don't know that he actually came up with it, but Bob Higgs was the first person that I ever saw that presented this thought pattern, that it's not our responsibility to prove that anarchism is better than statism. They're the ones murdering people. There are no anarchists killing people. I mean, there are right. accusations of crazy kids with black hoods that might call themselves anarchists that do stupid things, but that's not the true philosophical anarchism that we're talking about here. But I think it was Bob Higgs that I first saw that made this argument. But the guy in this article here really fleshes it out and does a good job with it. It's the truth, though. You think about it. Who do we have to convince of this? How is it that we have to prove every single point when it's statism that literally bulldozers are pushing the bodies up in piles of hundreds of millions of dead people? And that's, we can't think of a better way to do it than that. Is that really the only way that we can walk around and have an Orange Julius on one corner and a Subway on another corner and a drive-through car wash? The only way we can do that is, you know, a million Ukrainians dead or a million Iraqis dead. That's the only way you can think of? There's no other way? And you want me to justify how anarchy would work?
But yet here we are. Like, aren't we constantly, like, sort of in that? And, you know, it's great that you mentioned Robert Higgs. What a gem of a man. I mean, what an incredible body of work that he's produced. And there is that, I'm looking for that great quote. This is Robert Higgs. Anarchists did not carry out genocide against the Armenians in Turkey. They did not deliberately starve millions of Ukrainians. They did not create a system of death camps to kill Jews, Gypsies, and Slavs in Europe. They did not firebomb scores of large German and Japanese cities and drop nuclear bombs on two of them. They did not carry out the Great Leap Forward that killed scores of millions of Chinese. They did not attempt to kill everybody with any appreciable education in Cambodia. They did not launch one aggressive war after another. They did not implement trade sanctions that killed perhaps 500,000 Iraqi children. In debates between anarchists and statists, the burden of proof clearly should rest on those who trust conjectural. The state's mayhem is undeniably, factually horrendous. Okay? Yeah. Robert Higgs. Bam.
Bob Higgs, I've said this many times, Bob Higgs is leaps ahead the wisest man I've ever known. I really mean that.
Wow.
You know, think of it this way. You're driving down the street. You're just cruising along down the street, and you see a car come up very quickly behind you, and you notice that he has a bank of lights on that car. Do you go, oh, no, there's an anarchist right behind me, and fear pulls into your chest, tightens, and you think, oh no, this anarchist is going to pull me over and search my car, maybe rough me up if I'm the wrong color, and, you know, charge me a tax for driving 2 miles an hour over the speed or 10 miles an hour over the speed or whatever. No, anarchists don't do that.
Never.
Never. Never happens.
Nope.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Freedom Fiends. Redemption in the third act. My name is Ben Stone. With me is James Babb. And we are on the Freedom Fiends Radio, and we're talking about this article over at Art of Not Being Governed, called "The Fundamental Flaw in Non-Anarchistic Libertarian Thought." Let me give it a shout out in a different direction too. There's a wonderful book that is the inspiration of the name of this website, and the book is called "The Art of Not Being Governed," and it's by a professor at Yale, I believe, and I think Yale Press produced the book, The Art of Not Being Governed. It's a really good book that talks about anarchist societies that have existed not only in the past but currently exist. And I'm not talking about little enclaves of communists living someplace in Germany or living someplace in France where they, you know, they all live in some bombed out or some ratted out former factory that's been abandoned or what. That's not what I'm talking about. There are whole societies of anarchists living peaceably in different places in the world today, where the governments of the world have not been able to reach them, and they live, and some of them, you know, very old societies, and they get along quite well. They're not without law. They're not without rules. They're just without rulers. And that's really the key. They still have rulers. They still have rules. They do not have rulers.
Well, that's an important distinction. That's very important. And, you know, for people listening, they're thinking, oh, they're talking about anarchy. Oh, my gosh. They're picturing, like, people smashing Starbucks windows, or that's not real anarchy. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about people just lawlessly it's not Mad Max we're talking about.
Right.
We're talking about people that live by natural laws of, you know, basically the non-aggression principle. Don't hurt somebody else. Don't take somebody else's stuff. Or the very natural, it's way human beings interact normally. That's how we live our lives. We walk down the street with these principles. We don't hurt people. We don't go out of our way to take people's stuff. That's just how people live.
If I had to point out a flaw, and I have to say again, this is a really good article, and I appreciate the author, and really it's good. If I had to point out a flaw in the article, because I tend to, you know, I'm kind of a critic, and I kind of do that with things. I look for what's wrong with something. But if I had to point out a flaw in this, it would be the phrase in here that why not try something new in reference to the government. The government has been showing itself for centuries, for thousands of years, as nothing but a human-killing monster. And so why not try something new? Now, I appreciate the logic in that, but the fact is, anarchism, like we're describing, is not new. It is the default setting for human beings. It's what we do when there's True. Not a gang of thieves lording over us. In the Old West, when people went out and whole societies were developed in different places throughout the Old West, they were very peaceful, and the bulk of evidence proves that. And Bill and I have talked about this on previous Freedom Fiends shows. When people are left alone without government, they tend to get along, and they tend to figure out how to take care of this law situation without government. It's only when Right. the government comes in and starts to interfere with that there's a problem. So it's not really something new.
And yeah.
Go ahead, James.
No, that's a good point. It may be new to certain people as an idea, though. So I think that's what the author was trying to think of. But you know, and I would just add, not only do we naturally collaborate peacefully with people, but when we do, amazing things are accomplished.
Yeah,
great works of art, of technology, of invention. Like the you say, well, necessity is among what can I do? There's people that want to buy this car for me. They want to voluntarily give me money. What can I do to make them want it even more? Oh, I got an idea for a better carburetor. Whoa. Yeah. You know, and technology moves forward and advance after advance after advance. We get these incredible increases to our standard of living. I mean, we are living better than kings of a century or two ago. This is every luxury is available to people we would even consider poor. So we need to emphasize this voluntary interaction is the key to prosperity.
It absolutely is. James, thanks a ton for coming on the show with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ben.
It's always fun to talk to you. We're, you know, for folks out there listening, it's so much true with many of the fiends. Not only are we friends on the internet, but we're friends in real life. I really appreciate James and his family.
Likewise. Great that we could reach out across the fiend zone, across the world, the fiend phone.